It's episode 108 of Breaking Trail. We're talking food, music, and making change in the living room.
As I've gotten older, I've actually taught myself or become more accustomed or embraced. This is hard. I'm not comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I'm going to dig in.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Breaking Trail Podcast, biweekly conversations with outdoor actor professionals and athletes who are redefining success and living life on their own terms. We are Breaking Trail. I'm Lisa Gerber, and I help purpose-driven individuals make their idea of change happen through more effective storytelling. You can learn more at bigleapcreative.com. If you're new, welcome. Hope you stick around. You can find me on Instagram or LinkedIn at Lisa Gerber, or contact me, lisa@breakingtrailpod.com. Love to hear from you with questions and guest suggestions. Cheryl Weiser is the director of outreach at Tilth Alliance and leads staff for the Eat Local First Collaborative, a multi-partnership collaboration between food system organizations around the state. Communicator and narrative storyteller, Cheryl is recognized as a builder of strategic partnerships with career experience in the nonprofit, corporate, civic, and media sectors. She is a passionate advocate for sustainable agriculture and consumer education, promoting local food and farms. She is also a highly regarded singer, songwriter, and musician. In 2017, she launched Pie and Persistence, a Seattle-based house concert series, which has raised over $40,000 for social, food, land, and environmental justice. A few of her quotes that I loved, just to give you sort of a flavor for our conversation, is meet people where they are, not where you want them to be, and progress moves at the speed of trust. We sort of went all over the place on this conversation, so I can't really give it one like theme or story, but it was about resilience and storytelling and music. And she does everything with this writer's voice that brings it all to life in a beautiful way. So with that, I am going to turn it over to our conversation. What I know about you so far is you're a big advocate of local agriculture, eating local, and lots of other causes, in fact. You're also a wonderful musician. I've been listening to your music, and we're going to link up on SoundCloud to that. You've also started this great initiative called Pie and Persistence, where you have raised more than $40,000 for a variety of causes. So I'm looking forward to exploring all of these different things. But what I'd like to do is start back early and ask you, as a kid, do you recall, like, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was a dreamy kid. I lived in a, I don't think I had an aspiration about what I wanted to be when I grew up. In some ways, I think I knew who I already was, you know, when I was a very little girl. I'm sorry, what?
How unusual.
Yeah, I know. When I was a little girl, I used to walk to school and I must have been 6 years old, and I would make up songs all the time. So it'd be winter and, you know, I'd be wearing gloves and walking down the street and pretending they were the microphone. But I was dreaming of stories and songs, and I had such a love of the natural world then. I was always really intrigued. As a kid, we traveled up to Cape Cod quite a bit, and I loved tide pools. And I was just fascinated by nature, and I could stare for hours at a tide pool. So I didn't really have a strong sense of what I wanted to be growing up. I think I knew I wanted to leave home, that I had a sense of adventure, that I was not in the box that I was not in the family box, you know, like the family square. There wasn't really a square for me. And I do remember having a creative writing teacher in high school, the amazing Mrs. Greenagle. Oh, I used amazing. one of Lisa's do not go to words. Mrs. Greenagle was, I think, one of the first people who really encouraged me as a writer and as a creative person to dream about how to live that life.
I love that you kind of knew what it's like. You don't have to know exactly what you want, but you knew what you loved. You had a really keen sense of what mattered and what didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I can relate to this not fitting into a family. I, being a storyteller myself, not a musician, but I read a lot of books as a kid, and I knew also that I didn't just want that, like, I just want to get married and have kids and live in the suburbs kind of thing, right? There's like something mm-hmm. else out there, but you don't know exactly what it mm-hmm. is.
No, you don't. And, you know, I grew up as a kid who was, like I said, you know, kind of outside the family square, but also I grew up, you know, very heavy. You know, I was a large kid. I was shy. I was introverted. Kids really teased me. This was before the internet. And in some ways, thank God it was, because I remember being really bullied in school. But when in the summers, I would go to a summer camp. My mom got a job at a summer camp when I was 5 years old. And I went there every summer of my life until I was 18. I was a camper, then I was a junior counselor and a senior counselor. And that's where I would play music. And I had a completely different kind of life and was, you know, had friends and really accepted. But I think what I knew about myself is that I wanted to be free. And I wanted to be free of what was expected or unexpected of me.
Yeah. So how did you make that? I mean, I was going to go straight to how is it that what brought you to the work that you do today? But I feel like that's too broad of a leap right now, because there's so many things that had to happen. Like, you had to get past this bullying, and you clearly shed the weight, and both physical and emotional, it sounds like.
I think it's been a life, you know. I mean, at 63.
You are not. Right now?
Yeah, I'm 63. It's all that rock and roll.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, I used the word. That's awesome.
Cheryl and Lisa's amazing adventure. I've said this to my friends, that sometimes it takes a lifetime to become the person that you want to be. And I go one step further, that it takes a lifetime to become the human or the woman that you want to be. Because there's all of this different things that are attached to how we become in the world, whatever our journey is, whether it's, you know, you're a cis female or, you know, whatever that looks like. Mm-hmm. For me, getting to where I am now has been a journey in loss, redemption, resiliency, repeat. Yeah. And it's also been about love. It has been about community. It has been about all of the things that are character building in a lot of ways, for lack of a better word. But I think that I have some really strong genes. You know, I look back at my grandparents and how they came to this country. You know, I'm second generation American. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, got on a boat from her small town in Ukraine, Rivne, came over here when she was 18 years old, didn't know anybody. You know, my grandfather, his story, the man that she married, is, you know, insane. He was conscripted into the Russian army as a Ukrainian Jew. And he fought in the Russo-Japanese War in the early 1900s. And then he stole a Russian cavalry officer's horse and cart and escaped and came because Dubnow, where he was on the Polish border, came to America eventually. And my father's parents came from Kiev. And, you know, there's a lot of stories in my family also during World War II about family resiliency. So I think that there was a narrative, even though I didn't know it as a kid, that didn't necessarily come from my parents, but I think it came from the immigrant part of my family about how they came to this country.
Yeah.
And their work and their resiliency. It's really pretty profound. My father's mother, the story has it that she and her sister, younger sister, stowed away on a boat and came to America. And I think my grandmother was 16. I mean, what kind of presence of mind is that?
Yeah.
This is not, you know, 1970. This is the early 1900s.
Right. Totally different.
Yeah, it's crazy, you know? Yeah. So, you know, those stories, you know, cycle up for me even today as we're going through all of these challenges in our world of, I think back, what would my grandmother do right now?
Yeah, because it sounds like, well, if you wanted to leave your family, it sounds like you had, not your grandparents, but it sounds like you had some greater challenges than just that. And so you had to really rely on yourself to get through that.
I did. I was on my own financially and, you know, emotionally in every single way that you could possibly be when I was 18 years old. And I went to school in Boston and, you know, I wasn't prepared for it at all. I actually majored in journalism and minored in probably too many recreational favors. And it was, but it's where I met some of my dearest and oldest friends today. So that was, you know, opening myself up to a very large city and being a very young, free-spirited artist, creative person. And then, you know, after about 2 years, I dropped out of college and because I couldn't afford it anymore. And I headed west and I went to Colorado.
So what drew you out there? That's what I'm curious, is how you go from there to, you live in Seattle now and you do this work for, you know, specifically in farming and food, and what brought you to that spot now?
To this place?
Yeah.
I think it's just been a continual migration. And part of it, I think, has been originally, you know, in the early part of my life, that path of freedom and always having a love for the natural world, a love for landscape. And when I had a friend that lived out in Colorado, and she said, well, why don't you come out here for a while? You know, you're 21 years old. The world is your oyster. And so when a friend says, come out and live in Colorado, you go out and live in Colorado. And the first morning I was there, we went up to the Continental Divide, and I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And I think the writer in me recognized the power of the place that I was in. I think place, as it relates to natural landscape and the natural world, has always held something for me. It has always been where I have found my footing, where I find my faith and I keep my faith. It's where I go to reset and to where I feel the most comfortable in a lot of ways. And so Colorado really gave me this very different life than I had ever imagined growing up back east. And it started this lifelong love affair with the West, with the natural world, with the power of mountains, always knowing that those mountains were way more powerful than anything human beings were throwing down. And you had to respect that. And what you can learn from, you know, the power of a 14,000-foot peak, right?
Absolutely.
and then it also turned me on to different writers. You know, that's where I started, you know, meeting other musicians and writers and artists. I was actually part of a really great scene in Denver. There's still a cafe there. It's called the Mercury Cafe. It's quite legendary. And it was a great scene. And there was just a ton of artists and writers and musicians there. And It's where I was being exposed. I was getting whatever the equivalent was of my college education around literature, around art, around music, and people that I was listening to. That's where I started reading Edward Albee and being introduced to the politics of land and the politics of the West. Mm-hmm. And so it was a self-taught journey. And then in 1984, I was thinking I was going to go to Europe. And I had another friend that lived out here in Seattle and said, why don't you come out and visit me in Seattle? Hello. So, it was great. I'll go out to Seattle. I didn't have enough money to move out to Europe. And I moved out here. I left Colorado on Halloween 1984. I took the train out. And again, it was landscape. I remember the train wending its way up the Oregon coast and seeing this Pacific Northwest mist and the gray and the green. And it was velvety and gray and smoky, like smoky as in color. And I was like, okay. It was completely different from Colorado in the West, which was that kind of golden, bright landscape. And it was kind of a little mushy. But it was also fascinating because my first day in Seattle going to Pike Place Market, and this was in the mid-80s, so it was a very different market. And seeing this vibrancy and houseboats and, it was a completely different life. And so over the years, I've been part of so many different communities in Seattle. So my first jobs in Seattle were at Pike Place Market. Huh. I sold on the stalls.
Nice.
I still have some really dear friends that are in my world, my food and farm world, that we have all kinds of relationships going back to Pike Place Market. And then I started working for nonprofits. My first nonprofit gig was for the Early Music Guild, and I was their staff administrator. And, again, I didn't have a degree, but I had an affinity for story, for language, for connecting people. So I worked for them. Then I went to work for the Philadelphia String Quartet and, worked on the Olympic Music Festival and kind of hung around in the arts for a while. Mm-hmm. And then slowly started to move into the work around environment and food. And that started with an organization called Earth Ministry. I was their first staff person. And Earth Ministry is a very interesting organization based here in Seattle. They were started through the Episcopal Church. And I actually had a gig. I worked at St. Mark's Cathedral for a while in Seattle.
Yeah.
Which is great. I loved being like the Jewish girl who worked at St. Mark's Cathedral. But their library was filled with the most amazing books. I got to read, Sir Thomas Merton and work on really great projects there. And there was something that...
That's the one on Capitol Hill, right?
They call it the Holy Box.
Overlooking. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I overlooking the city.
Go ahead. Keep going. I have an amazing memory from there, but yeah.
Yeah. So in between, and mixed in with all of this nonprofit work is the music life that is also happening simultaneously. And that's a whole other piece. And so Earth Ministry was really interesting because they started as a faith-based ecumenical ministry. I know there's an oxymoron there. It's part of the Episcopal Church on the premise of environmental stewardship, environmental justice. And how that was based in faith-based communities. And this is 96. And at the time, we were just kind of starting some of the pea patches in Seattle. There wasn't a lot of conversations around, we're going to the farmer's market, farm to table. So I think that they were really at the forefront of this work, of working with different kinds of faith-based congregants, whether they were Jewish, they were evangelical, they were in the Protestant tradition, whatever it was. And what did it mean to care for the earth? Whether it was about how we grew our food, how we managed our trash. It was really fascinating work. I loved it a lot. It opened up a lot of doors for me. And one of those doors was around storytelling, so that when I would talk with members of the press about the work that we were doing, and they immediately latched on to it being a faith-based organization, you know, those were some interesting conversations of how could you shift that narrative of this is what you think, but there's really important work that's being done here. You can't deny the voice that people have because they might be working from this, a faith-based perspective. And then I took some more detours after that work, you know, did some work around events like the Fremont Fair and Bumper Shoot and Folk Life. You know, it's been kind of a circus life, to tell you the truth. I have literally worked with clowns. I really have.
Oh, all right. Was that, well, you said you auditioned for Cirque du Soleil, but yeah.
No, I did some PR work for Feld Brothers or Feld Entertainment. And so when Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus would come to town, they would hire me to help with the media. And I have literally helped clowns run through the Pike Place Market. And I've been to the clown car when they weren't wearing their makeup, and they're really surly.
Really?
So, I mean, actually, it was a really, it was a great experience. Mm-hmm. There were some really great clowns that I did get to work with.
That's sorry, like a just, fantastic quote right
there. I can't
there.
Help it.
I mean, we've all worked with clowns, but I'm not sure that they were great clowns.
Mm-hmm. But again, that experience taught me about the power of storytelling because at that time, this was the 90s, you know, when we set up this whole media thing that we were doing at Pike Place Market, and it was Ashley Feld was very generous. They were, they did a whole thing where they did a big donation back to Pike Place Market, but we literally had the clowns running through the market, you know, interacting with fish throwing and everything. And every TV camera in within, I don't know how many miles was there. It was like, it was the idea of what captures people's attention. What, you know, when you say, I've worked with clowns or we're going to have clowns running through the market.
Yeah.
People go, I want to see that.
Yeah.
So again, it goes back to honing those instincts for storytelling. How do you connect with people? How do you bring them in?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's with clowns and sometimes it's with very real things.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, I'm curious about, you said they have this perception. So when you're using story to shift perception, pretty challenging there, but especially when it comes to the faith-based piece of that, don't know if you can, I think that's a challenge so many have to face with that.
Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing conversation. I mean, it happens in my work now in talking to, you know, working with media or funders or, you know, stakeholder partners when you're talking about local food.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly with media folks that I think over the past decade, we've really glorified farm to table and kind of the local food to farm tableau.
Yeah.
And COVID has shown us that we had some very real issues with our food system. And we cannot take our food system and how our food is grown or produced or harvested or, you know, all those things. We cannot take it for granted in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so there have been, you know, when we launched the Eat Local First Collaborative, which Tilth Alliance is a partner of, along with other food systems orgs, last November, there have been some really fantastic conversations with local media. I'm actually really happy about the tone of the conversations that are taking place. I think there is more understanding of those fault lines and those issues that are at stake.
Yeah.
Sorry, I jumped ahead about 25 years.
Actually, that's great. I'm really curious. Can you give an example when you say that COVID highlighted some shortcomings in our food system? Can you give an example or two at a high level?
Sure. Whew. Well, I think if you look at, for example, how our food is, who picks our food?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So in other words, if we look at the essential work that farm workers around this country do, not only farm workers, but those who work in meatpacking plants. So you had last spring, you had, thousands of employees in meatpacking plants all around the country that, you know, were getting sick and they were not being given adequate protections. People were going into supermarkets, they were seeing supply chains being interrupted, they were seeing higher prices, we had shortages. And even within that one little example right there, there's also the larger issue of consolidation, because over the years, many mid-size or regional butchering operations, or, you know, they could be like a mid-size, not a mom and pop shop, but you'll have these large conglomerates that are doing animal processing, but kind of those mid-size ones have been, that's consolidation in the market. You see it in healthcare, you see it in other sectors. And so what happened on a local level and is continuing to add pressure to our own regional and statewide food system, particularly for, many people want to be able to source food from a farmer they know, they want that relationship, they want to be able to source local meat, then those smaller meat processors, were telling the farmers, they became so impacted, they could not handle processing for many of those smaller farmers. And so that has also caused, it's about scaling to capacity. And so all of this work has been happening over many years, but COVID really brought a lot of things like that into sharp focus. Mm-hmm. This is, for example, one place along the food supply chain that we need to be able to develop more ways for local livestock farmers to be able to do their own, how to be able to have their own WSDA, Washington State Department of Agriculture processing, how some of those pinch points can be unpinched. Another place would be, we just finished, it's still on, doing a whole promotion for Eat Local First around CSAs, which is Community Supported Agriculture, which is a great way for consumers to get their local groceries, have a one-on-one relationship with their local farmer. And so last year, CSA farms were seeing an enormous demand after there's been a period of decline for them because of places like Blue Apron and other businesses kind of coming online. But last March, all of a sudden, demand for CSA just went through the roof. And that demand is still very high. And I think that trend will continue. So those are just kind of two places. But I think another place is going back to farm workers. Right now, it is really essential for us to ensure that our farm workers are vaccinated. And there are issues with that around the country because you have farm workers that are working in different states, and farm workers don't stay in one place. You have farm workers that start maybe in Florida working on tomatoes, and then they go to New Jersey, I think in the summer, to do blueberries. There's different paths around that. And then, we have our farm workers here in Washington who many of them, first of all, weren't getting adequate protection. And secondly, we need to make sure that migrant populations and migrant workers who are essential are getting the essential services and protection that they need, because they help deliver our food. So that's just one place. When you bite into an apple, you're not necessarily thinking about what's happening with that apple that is from Washington State and how that came to your plate. There's all kinds of pieces that are also involved in transportation, you know, processing.
Yeah.
So I know I got super wonky. I'm really sorry.
No, I think it's it's so interesting. And I just learned so much. Like, I think we know inherently, you know, I just think when I travel to Europe, how much better, I just think it's standard. It's a totally different way of life, the food system there. Correct me if I'm wrong, but here we have everything mass produced. You have a strawberry, you get an apple. It doesn't taste nearly as good from the regular grocery store as if you just go in Europe. They just shop much more locally. They eat more locally. It's a much more localized system.
Mm-hmm. No, it really is. And, you know, I think that the demand, though, we have a demand for organic food in this country, but we don't have a demand to preserve farmland. And that's another issue.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I think that there is still a fundamental lack of understanding that as much as we love local food, we have to love the land and we have to have a fundamental understanding. Land is so interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. They who have the land have the power. And, you know, that's a whole other piece of, you know, who is farming and who has access to farmland, who has access to capital. Because, you know, that's also lots of pieces in there about equity and about really unjust systems that have been at play for decades and decades. And so, you know, we could go on with this conversation.
Yeah, well, actually, there are a couple of questions I have for you. I mean, you mentioned the equitable piece of it. And I want to get there because the mission for Eat Local First is an equitable, or it's actually the Seattle Tilth, I believe, is the equitable future. But before I get there, you mentioned the migrant workers, and you mentioned in 2016 the election influenced you starting Pie and Persistence, which I think there's kind of a link there, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I would love to hear about getting this idea to bring together. I mean, it brings together the things that you love and are passionate about into one really amazing thing. I use the word amazing again. That's going to be the theme of this episode.
I'm so grateful that you asked me that question. I really am. As you can imagine, in our current COVID times, being a musician and being a musician who was performing pretty frequently, and, you know, as much as I'm trying and working on embracing streaming, it's not the same thing. So I'm grateful to be able to have a place to talk about music. Back in 2016, it was right after the election. And actually, I remember I was working on the Tilth Conference in Yakima, Washington, and it was the night before the Tilth Conference, and the election had happened, and Leonard Cohen had just died, and I stayed up the whole night listening to Leonard Cohen, and it was a week later that I did this house concert with my dear friend Christy McWilson from the Pickets, who's a brilliant songwriter. And she said, "Cheryl, let's play This Land Is Your Land." And I know that song has become not something I do anymore, but it kind of started where this Pie and Persistence, the genesis came from. We did this really beautiful, rootsy, slow version, and I watched about 40 people hang their heads. A lot of them are crying. Some of them had their hands on their hearts. And I remember thinking, living rooms are really powerful places, and this is where I need to be. And so I started thinking about how could I bring people together. And the following spring, I was in Boston, and my friend had a house concert. And this was really, this was the first Pie in Persistence. And she said, you know, I came to visit. She's, and we were like, let's do a house concert. She had a beautiful house. And we raised money for a program in Boston that supported, that worked with international victims of torture. And it was through one of the hospitals. We raised over $5,000. And it, you know, and there was food and people were talking. You know, this all took me a while to pull together to kind of get to Pie and Persistence, because the persistence part came after Elizabeth Warren stood up in the Senate. And it was basically still she persisted.
Yeah.
And Pie is the most, to me, some may disagree that love paella. Paella, but I think pie is one of the most universal foods. And there's a lot of ways to look at pie. And for me, Pie and Persistence and raising money is not about giving smaller slices. It's about how do you make a bigger pie. And it's evolved over time to focusing on organizations, causes, campaigns that are focused on justice. Primarily around land justice, food justice, it can be social justice, environmental justice. It's all the J's with all the words in front of them. Mm-hmm. For my birthday in 2020, I did a very small one, but it benefited one of our Black-owned farms here in Seattle and also an organization in, I want to say, South Carolina or North Carolina. That is, it's not about reparations, but what they do, it helps to return land to Black owners that has been systemically taken over hundreds of years through. There's a word for it. It's a type of will, and I can't. There's a legal term for it, and it's. I don't have it off the top of my head right now. And then last summer, I did a virtual Pie in Persistence, and we raised about just shy of $4,000 for Got Green, the Northwest Justice Project, which to support migrant workers in Yakima. And we raised money for Urban Garden for African community housing and development. And we had homemade pies as giveaways and all kinds of prizes. So it's taken me a while to get to this place of here's what we're doing and why. Mm-hmm. But I think with COVID, pre-COVID, the place I had gotten to that I was the most excited about with Pie and Persistence was what I'll call the sort of, not the surprise factor, but how to bring people together in a way that we would raise money and we would be able to pay it forward in a place where it was least expected. So what we did in August of 2019 is we raised money for a food bank back in Ohio. And this was where it was in Lordstown, Ohio. It's where the GM plant had been. The GM plant had closed, and it was, that county had extraordinary rates of poverty and hunger, particularly among kids. And I remember I read this article in the New York Times about what happens to a company town when the company town closes. And I thought, well, what would happen if this check showed up out of the blue from neoliberal Seattle to this food bank in Ohio? It just said, we love you. Hang in there. Because this community, this part of Ohio up until 2016 had always voted Democratic. So it was kind of like, how do you start to change the conversation or the belief systems that people have about one another? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you make progress in conversation? Mm. And we did that. We raised probably just a little bit under $1,000. We sent a check. We got the most beautiful letter back. And that's where I was going with Pie and Persistence, before COVID hit. And now there's, you know, the need is great everywhere.
Yeah.
This is great.
It's overwhelming. You
know? I just donated some money to the Cranks Creek Survival Center in Harlan County, Kentucky. I had a great conversation with them. They're really cool people. And, you know, I'm just like, the way that they take care of their community. And again, I just wanted to shift that narrative. Like, here's some love coming from Seattle, Washington.
Yeah.
And people are not always what you think you are. So it's, you know, we have to have tough conversations in this world.
Yeah.
And they start with love, really.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the next question. You sent me a beautiful quote by E.M. Forster. I'm going to read it because I'm assuming you don't have it right in front of you, or maybe you have it in your head. But this is the author of Howard Zinn, Room with a View, many, many different things. Only connect. That was the whole of her sermon. Only connect the prose and the passion, and both will be exalted, and human love will be seen at its height. Live in fragments no longer. So I wanted to ask you why that, how that has so much meaning for you, and to talk a little bit about this idea of that it's not love, it's not only love, it's, you know, it's relationships, it's this idea of collaboration, which is at the root of everything you're doing.
I think what stands out for me in that quote, I love the quote in its entirety, but it is the brevity and with the clarity of only connect. It's like a clarion call to the, to that's, oh, it's been this, it's been my mantra for a very long time now about how we show up, about our word, about our deed, and how we have resilience. So connecting for me is kind of everything. And it's about meeting people where they are, not where I think that they should be. That's taken a while to learn.
That's a good lesson.
Love is, you know, there's all kinds of love in this world. There's, and this comes back to working at St. Mark's and in the Episcopal Cathedral and learning about agape, right? And learning about all of the different, many different forms of love. And it is, oh man, I witnessed, I think one of the most powerful things about loving and connecting is when it is the hardest. And when we are at our most broken. And so an example of that would be, I think we had talked a little bit in the questions about, I lived 100 yards from Cafe Racer in the Roosevelt District. And in 2012, you know, there were very dear souls that were killed in a mass shooting on May 30th, 2012. And it rocked so many people's lives. And Racer was part of my community. And I lived with people who worked there. It is where I had started playing music again after 10 years of not playing. It was where I felt this connection and community in Seattle in ways that I didn't always feel. And I watched in the ensuing months and years. And there's still these bonds that are based on Racer, which was about love. And I remember after the shooting, my friend Kurt Geisel, who owned Racer, even though the cafe was closed, and it was very eerie that summer, but there was a neon sign, the letters love, that he had put into the window. And so while the cafe was being, you know, cleaned and remodeled, that red neon sign, love, blinked every night. And it was through, it was the glue and the power of that connection.
Yeah.
Of building together through that kind of trauma. It taught me so much. It completely changed my life. It really did. You cannot witness that kind of loss and violence and not be changed by it and see how other people around you are affected by it. You cannot. You don't come through unscathed in any way.
Yeah.
You know, so really what it taught me was the power of living in the present and connecting. It goes back to connecting.
Yeah.
Why connecting is so important, because our lives, our worlds, it's all finite.
Yeah.
You know, there are no guarantees and there are no safety nets in the circus.
That's such an important story to share. It gives such life to a word that I feel gets overused sometimes. And so it really makes it, you know, what does that mean to connect? You know, I mean, it helps bring that to life.
I agree with you. It does get overused a lot. Connecting is about how you show up and how and where you show up. And sometimes you keep showing up even when it's hard.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Especially when it's hard.
I know. And you can just bring that lesson right down to the day-to-day stuff, right? Just when you just don't feel like doing something. And yeah, I mean.
Yeah. It's a weird thing, though. I think as I've gotten older, I've actually taught myself or become more accustomed or embraced. This is hard. I'm not comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I'm going to dig in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Such a better reaction than run away to where I cannot have this feeling and be okay.
Well, there's that too.
Sometimes that is a good idea, but I hear you. It's much more, it's rewarding when you can dig in. We don't have that much time left, and I had so many other questions for you, but is there anything, I mean, this is such a broad, I hate asking this question, but is there anything you wish that I might have asked that you really were hoping to talk about?
Wow. We got to talk about so many things.
I know.
And I probably talked too much about all of them. I do want to just say that for full context, so TILF Alliance is the organization that I work for. I'm the director of outreach there. And so we are a member of the Eat Local First Collaborative. So I want to encourage everyone to go and check out Eat Local First if they're looking to connect with local food and farms in Washington State.
Yeah.
And if they're you're a local farmer or farmer's market or a business that is sourcing from local farms, you can have a free listing on the website. So we really want to get people using this resource because it's unique and we really don't have anything like it in the state. We kind of launched this new platform. And musically, I will warn folks in advance, there's not a lot of new material on SoundCloud, but I'm slowly moving towards, again, at this lovely junction of 6 and 3 age-wise, how do I transform myself into being able to do more streaming, more home recording, and you know, what does performing again look like? But I'm actually really focusing on recording. I've been writing a lot of music.
Cool.
And I just really want to encourage people who are listening to really take care of themselves right now. People are going through a really hard time. Like they've really hit a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're all struggling to find our footing right now. There's a lot of that going on. And that's part of connecting too, is acknowledging that we are not all making these perfect COVID transitions.
Mm, by a long shot. And I love, you know, what you said about meeting people, say that again, meeting people where they are, not where you expect them to be. That's a big one.
Right. Meet them where they are, not where you want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That my other favorite one is trust moves at the speed of progress.
Mm-hmm.
No, wait. Progress moves at the speed of trust.
makes more sense.
Because when you're doing a lot of work with different communities, so we do at TILF, and I do a lot of work around the state with different communities and different stakeholders, and they there are some of them are looking at what we're doing right now with Eat Local First and going, well, yeah, what is this new elephant in the room? Mm-hmm. And it's it's just really about finding out from people what they want, what they value, what's important to them, and seeing where is some of that common ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wanted to add, so that's eatlocalfirst.org, and I'm going to link up to both your music and to that in the show notes. But, back to this collaboration piece that we were talking about, I mean, Eat Local First, that's based on changing the food system through collaboration, through all these different organizations.
That's a great way to look at it. I think what's pretty great about this project is the way that these different food system orgs came together, over the last couple of years. But last year was really kind of the big push. It was because things were happening so quickly. But it seems that collaboration is everywhere. People are recognizing, particularly if you're doing nonprofit work, partnership, collaboration, ways that people can work together. I'm seeing more and more of that all the time, and it's really a welcome change. The idea that you have, 10 organizations that are working on, where people are kind of like, no, this is my fiefdom, and I'm not sharing right. these resources or this with you. That doesn't feel as prevalent as maybe it's been in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think I would definitely credit a next generation mindset power to the people kind of shifting around hierarchy and dismantling some of those hierarchies to really get in the room and kind of look at that, so that that's really powerful. And there's a lot of work that's being done on where can we make space? Where can we make room? What are we not doing? What are we missing? So I wouldn't credit Eat Local First and the Eat Local First Collaborative with being the only one in the room that's doing that work. But sure. I think that we surmounted some previously held territory and just came together, and it's like, let's do this. We're a pretty scrappy band. It's pretty great. It's very nervy.
Well, I love it. I just hope, like you said, I just hope that mindset expands, because we don't see it everywhere, but let's hope for that. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing all of this amazing information.
Lisa, thank you so much for giving me the time and giving me the space. I look forward to more conversations with you off the mic and off LinkedIn. So let's keep this combo going.
Thank you for joining in, and hope you're enjoying the newly relaunched Breaking Trail podcast. I'll link up to all the resources and contact info in the show notes at breakingtrailpod.com. That's also where you can get in touch with me for comments, questions, and guest suggestions. Hey, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I hope you will subscribe, share, and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Those reviews and shares are so important to getting this show out to more and more people like you. And one last thing, if you or your team need some guidance in using story to make change happen, contact me to learn more about coaching and training programs. Let's schedule some time to discuss. Lisa@breakingtrailpod.com, and I will see you in 2 weeks.